You're listening to Irish Radio Canada's Home and Abroad, and I'm delighted as we launch into 2025 to be having a chat with Sebastian Keaveney. And Sebastian wrote a book a few years back called Fever in the Jungle, and the title of its nature is tells it all. It's fever and the jungle. And this was, I got a reminder about this to mark the day of the epidemic preparedness and a day of observation. That it's annually at the end of December. And Sebastian, author of Fever in the Jungle, Inside the World of an Epidemic, Troubleshooter. And he has been at some of the most remote parts of the world that's off the beaten track in every sense of the word. And he's able to draw on his experiences of over 100 treatment, prevention and outbreak missions and describe it in vivid detail. And amidst the fight against HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, Ebola, and he takes us out of the hotel room bubbles and brings us into places like Sierra Leone, Sudan, and many other. And I know he would have been highly involved and active during what we all went through, which was the COVID epidemic. Sebastian, tough altar oath.
Thank you, Austin. Thank you so much, and my compliments on all your work. It's great to hear your voice.
Sebastian, you're a Dubliner. Is it Trinity or UCD? You're a graduate.
Trinity, actually, but maybe more interestingly, Austin. I ended up at the University of Cape Town in South Africa, and wasn't too many Dubliners out there, but a beautiful place and the start of those adventures and travels that you mentioned.
And ending up out there, like your work is, you would be, how would you describe your, you're not an an epidemiologist, or what would be your specialty?
I'd say, Austin, funnily enough, now that I'm thinking about it, talking to you, my speciality would be going to places where no one else really wanted to go at the time. Now, maybe there's some connection with Ireland there. You know, I don't know if that means you're expendable or if you've got a sense of humor or if you're just up for the adventure. But that's how it worked out. And yeah, I studied public health, but also international relations. And of course, there's a big overlap there. You know, if you don't get the diplomacy right, if you don't approach health efforts in the right way, as we saw with COVID, then they're not going to work out. So I think there was a need for both skills.
And I'm going to come back to this when you say, as we did with COVID, now we're being warned about avian flu or bird flu. So we'll come back and chat a little about that shortly. But what attracted you to this area, aside from finding yourself being abandoned, what attracted you to this line of work?
You know, Austin, I have to give credit to my dad. He came from a medical family out in Sligo, and he ended up, it's a strange story, but his dad was a doctor, and then he ended up moving to the UK during the Second World War, because I guess they had a shortage of doctors. So my dad ended up in British public school, boarding school, Ampleforth, so he ended up with the English accent and you know, quite posh in a way. But he couldn't break his ties with Ireland. So after many travels and adventures of his own, he ended up back in Trinity as a professor there. And he died in 2003 when I was actually working for AIB, of all places, in their San Francisco office. And I just figured, okay, banking, you know, has its moments, especially in a big American city. But I figured I would try and respect his legacy and carry on the family tradition. So that's how it began.
Fascinating. Give a nice start to my career in the Bank of Ireland, but not in San Francisco. More uncovered as we chat.
Yeah.
So then after you studied and went out to South Africa, how long did you spend out there? And given where you were traveling around, how many years were you in that neck of the woods?
It was a couple of years, Austin, 2004, 2005, to be precise. And as you know, I've surfed my whole life. I've written a couple of books on surfing as well as some academic ones. And it was a beautiful time of life. You know, I was 26, 27, I guess, somewhere around there. I had an old Peugeot 504, 1983. And I drove all over. My girlfriend was a great adventurer at the time as well. And it was a great experience, not just in terms of, you know, the landscape and the culture, but also that's where a lot of the public health issues were happening. So I was able to get into the townships and other remote areas to visit the clinics and check out the infectious disease programs. It was a really enlightening time.
Interesting from an Irish perspective, given here in Canada in 1847, the medical community stood up to help the Irish when they arrived, even to the extent of contracting disease themselves and dying. Was it ever a concern of yours when you were in the field that you were putting yourself at risk?
You know, funnily enough, Austin, I just got back from a trip, a mission, I guess you could say, to Fiji there in November. And out of all these different escapades and adventures, that's the first time I've ever gotten sick. Now I'm a bit older now, obviously, and that's my first trip into that kind of realm since COVID. But I've been lucky, same as yourself in a certain way. Health is wealth, that's for sure. And I never got sick, although a couple of close shaves. You do get exposed to some pretty unsanitary, insalubrious environments, but you just make the best of it, try to stay lucky.
And going into where you were going, needing to be vaccinated in advance, I'm sure, was a very important criteria. And also, I would imagine where you were, the availability of a vaccine may not have been that easy at times. And you talk in terms of, you know, the importance of recognizing the diplomacy as a part of public health and all those things. Were those issues that you were conscious of, or did they exist?
They existed, Austin. And funnily enough, in many ways, a lot of what played out during COVID, I experienced it in so many different ways before, not just in terms of vaccines. You can think about, for example, I can give you examples, reproductive health interventions in East Africa. When I was working on that, and suddenly there are cultural fears, religious fears, and fears of population control programs and indoctrination, and likewise with various HIV interventions. The list goes on and on, that if you don't get the message right, if you don't get the education right, if you don't have the trust, then it's not going to work out the way you'd envisaged it in a more controlled environment.
Not wanting to be negative in any way, but has anything changed in reality?
No, I think we're getting there. I think at the end of the day, from what I've experienced, Austin, and from what I've observed, especially in conflict zones, discernment and debate is a luxury. And when your back is really to the wall, in a really poor environment, in a really war-torn environment, you'll probably ask questions and doubt things. But if there's a chance that your health will be preserved from some intervention, even though there's a risk involved with it, you're probably going to accept it. Now, I don't know if you could call that progress, but I think as communications get better, as education gets better, as we learn the lessons from COVID, which were in turn learned from Ebola and HIV and TB and malaria in many countries, we're getting there. I think it's about trust in the medical system. And there's been some hard times, I would say, for the public health community since COVID, you know, and that hasn't ended. I think there's a lot of sometimes justified resentment, but I think we're getting back to a more balanced attitude towards our doctors and nurses and healthcare administrators now.
Would you point out there the question of trust? We're living in a world where when you would have started out, the ability for fake news to undermine what you would have known from a scientific perspective and experience to be beneficial. That nearly would be a harder epidemic to handle and face and work with than the actual bacteria or viruses that are out there at times.
You could easily say that, Austin. I mean, the realm of misinformation, disinformation, I also don't think it's limited to public health, to medicine and clinical work in any way. It's much more, it's much broader. These kind of, you know, beliefs are right across society in every realm. And what I compare it to, we're going off on a tangent here, but that's the way we like it, right? What I compare it to is TV in the 1950s. You know, TV appeared and suddenly everyone's seeing UFOs and TV was very kind of hypnotic. And I think we're in the same realm now in a different way, that we see a lot of news and we hear a lot of things and we automatically assume it to be true because it's coming out of a radio or off a computer. And I think the next generation, is my hope for the future, is that they're going to look at us like dinosaurs and they're just going to say these people were so, that generation was so gullible, the same way we look back at the 1950s. So that's my hope for the future.
So going back to what I said, which I have a brief conversation about, is that what we're being warned about now is avian flu or bird flu. And we're being told that potentially, or what I'm hearing is potentially, it could be even more devastating than COVID. And yet the message doesn't appear to be really getting out there.
Yeah, it's hard to say really what should be done. I think very justifiably, a lot of people, a lot of sectors are still burned out from COVID. As I said, there's still some resentment against the rules. And, you know, for many of us, including that first year when I was in Ireland in 2020, it was probably as close as many of us will get to actually living in a police state under martial law or however you want to describe it. You know, the guard at checkpoints. I couldn't even go surfing in the West. And it was a really challenging time. And some people suffered really badly, I think, psychologically. And those scars haven't gone away. So when you talk about avian flu and the next threat, I just wonder, are we ready for it? But one thing's for sure, I think the approach will necessarily be different to COVID. The one thing we learned from COVID and for future pandemics is the one thing that matters is hospital capacity. If you've got zero hospital capacity, that's fine. You can make as many rules as you want. Up until that point, probably better to let people have their freedom. But when hospitals are overflowing, that's the real marker.
But tied in with hospital capacity is having the staff to cater to hospital capacity. Physical beds, as you and I know, are inanimate objects, and that they do not administer remedies or care. The human side of it is the weak link in many ways.
It is, and we're so blessed in many countries to have a supply of, for example, nurses from places like the Philippines, you know, where they're so well trained and they're able to put up with all kinds of challenging conditions. I also think we've made great advancements technologically in terms of telehealth, so people don't even have to go into the hospital, perhaps just as a last resort, which, funnily enough, is the old-fashioned Irish way. most people that I know from my dad's generation, they did not want to go near a hospital. Hospital was death, and my dad had a morbid fear of hospitals, and he would check if he was a doctor, so he would check himself out regularly at the first opportunity.
I want to remind people the book is called Fever in the Jungle. The author is Sebastian Keaveney. You can get at it through the manuscript publisher, but it's also out there on Amazon. And I would urge that you take a look. And, you know, all these things we learn from experience. And if we don't have the experience, we learn from somebody else's experience. And in this situation, we are getting the benefit of Sebastian's experience. And I want to thank you, Sebastian. It's been great connecting and chatting and a real pleasure having you on the show.
It's an honor and a pleasure for me, Austin, and Many thanks to all of your listeners for tuning in. And of course, I'm available for follow-up as required, but otherwise, wishing you and all your listeners all the best for 2025.